Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's Explainer Episode 65. Today, we're joined with Christina Sandifer and Michael Cannon. Michael Cannon is from the Cato Institute, and Christina Sandifer is from the Goldwater Institute. And today, we're here to discuss Michael's new book, Recovery. So I'll go ahead and hand it off to you guys.
All right, great. Well, thank you to the Federalist Society, and thanks for joining me, Michael. This is a great book, and in this book, you attribute quite a few of the problems in the U.S. health sector to government intervention. And, you know, I think policymakers at the state and federal levels are routinely enacting these laws that they say are going to improve access to care, and they're going to lower prices. But inevitably, as you point out in the book, they just make things worse. So I'd really like to unpack that today and touch on some of the solutions that you propose. But before we get to all that, this is a Federalist Society podcast. So I thought it would be helpful to start by talking about the foundation for all of these recommendations that you make, and you take a rights-based approach to healthcare. So can you explain to me what kinds of rights people have in healthcare?
Sure. Thank you for having me, Christina, and the Federalist Society. I'm excited to talk about the book. It takes a rights-based approach because I agree with Bernie Sanders and Medicare for All supporters on this much. We do have rights when it comes to our healthcare. And the most important right is we have the right to make our own health decisions. And what we find is that we in the United States, government doesn't respect that right very much. But when it does, when the government does not insert itself into our health decisions and push us this way or that or ban this decision or that one, where it leaves the decisions to individual consumers and entrepreneurs in the competitive market process. What we see in healthcare, there are only a few corners where that happens, but what we see in healthcare is very encouraging. We see the same sorts of things that we see in other sectors of the economy, which is prices falling while quality improves. And so while I do take that rights-based approach, there's also a utilitarian angle to the book where I argue that when you take that rights-based approach, we get more of what everyone wants, which is better, more affordable, more secure, more universal healthcare, and a health system where fewer people fall through the cracks than under any other.
Well, now you say that there are a few corners of the healthcare sector where we see these markets flourishing, and then we can see how that benefits health consumers or patients. But I guess that means, and you say this in the book, that in totality, the U.S. healthcare market really isn't a free market. And I think that might surprise some listeners who are a little bit new to talking about the topic this way, because I think oftentimes we're told by politicians that it's the market or the free market that's actually destroying healthcare, and we need more government to come in and fix it. So what do you mean when you say that we don't have a free market in healthcare in most places?
So a lot of people complain about lots of parts of the U.S. health sector. Maybe the biggest complaint is that prices are too high, whether for medical care or health insurance, and health insurance is too insecure. People lose their coverage all the time, and then they are sick and don't have health insurance. And one of the distinguishing characteristics of the U.S. health sector is that relative to other countries, we do purchase a lot of health insurance and medical care through the private sector. So a lot of people just see that, and then they see all the problems in the U.S. health sector, and they say, oh, well, the private sector must be the problem. That's a very superficial perspective. I mean, I understand why people reach that conclusion, but it's superficial and it's misleading, because even though we're buying and selling a lot of healthcare and health insurance through the private sector, That doesn't mean that it is a market system or that buying and selling reflects consumers' preferences or the actual underlying costs of the goods and services that we're purchasing, because there's so much that the government does to distort private and control private sector healthcare decisions. And the biggest thing the government does is compel workers to enroll in a certain type of health insurance that I think is really junk insurance. And that is employer-sponsored insurance. About half of the US population has employer-sponsored insurance. And the reason they do is because if you buy insurance through an employer, letting an employer control $16,000 of your compensation and use that to make your health insurance decisions for you, and then enroll in a plan in that health insurance plan that your employer picks, a plan that, by the way, drops you when you leave, maybe after you've already gotten sick, and leave that employer, which is why I call it junk insurance. If you wanted to take that $16,000 as cash compensation, buy your own health insurance, it stayed with you between jobs, the government effectively penalizes you. It requires you to pay taxes on that money. You lose about a third of it to taxes. And therefore, most people just enroll in employer-sponsored insurance, which means that all of that money, that $16,000 of yours and mine and everyone else's, is not really private health. It might be private health spending, but it's not the market at work. It's not voluntary health spending. That is compulsory spending. Yeah, and so in the book,
that's why you call this the original sin of health policy, I believe, right? I think that's worth talking about before we get into how that money is sort of taken out of the market. I think it's just worth like really focusing on that point. I don't think a lot of people realize that it doesn't have to be this way and it wasn't always this way, right? I think it's hard for people to divorce health insurance from employment, because so many people just assume, you know, we have to get a job to get health insurance. We have to get health insurance from our job, and we have to have health insurance in order to have health care. So I think that point you made is really worth emphasizing.
That's right. I do call it in the book and elsewhere the original sin of U.S. health policy that the federal government made employer-sponsored health insurance compulsory in this way. And that gives it vast control over the health insurance and healthcare decisions of, as I said, more than half the population. And in the book, I show what that means on a sector-wide basis. I present some data that the OECD collected, and that, by the way, I haven't seen anywhere else. I had to find these data myself because no one else publicizes them, except for the OECD, which posts it on their website. The OECD ranks different countries on a lot of different metrics, including when it comes to healthcare. And usually it's that simple private versus government spending comparison. But they also have another comparison, which is voluntary spending versus voluntary health spending versus compulsory health spending. And when you look at how much of the health spending in the United States, the consumer controls, so it's voluntary, the government isn't pushing you one way or another, it's only about 17%. That means 83% of health spending is compulsory, which puts us close to the top among OECD nations. I think Germany is the top at like 85 or 86. So we're right there with Germany, with the worst of them. But then when you look at health spending as a share of GDP, because health spending is such a larger share of GDP than in the United States and other countries, it really comes clear why we spend so much more than other nations. As a share of GDP, compulsory health spending in the United States accounts for 14% of GDP. There's another 2% of GDP that's voluntary health spending, but 14%, and that is larger than total health spending in every other country. So that gives you an idea of, first of all, why we spend so much on healthcare in the United States. It's because the government compels us to do so, but also just how much control government has over our health decisions. That 14% of GDP, about 8 percentage points of that is government spending. So money that the government taxes from us and then spends. That's compulsory spending by the government, but the rest, another 6 percentage points of GDP, is what I mentioned before, about $1 trillion that of our earnings that employers get to control and use to purchase our junk health insurance, because the government will penalize us unless we let them do that. So because we'll lose some of that $16,000 to taxes. So the OECD recognizes that employer-sponsored insurance, all this what we call private health spending, is actually compulsory spending and does not reflect consumer preferences. It's not the market at work.
Yeah. No, I think that's fascinating. And I think, you know, you were alluding before that in the areas where we do have a quasi market or a bit of a market where consumers are able to actually spend money the way that they would prefer to on healthcare services, we see something very different happening than in these compulsory areas. And you have a thing in the book, I want to get the phrase right. I think you say it's the most important chart you've never seen. Is that right? Is that, I love all yes. your phrases, but where you kind of talk about what happens in those areas, right? So tell us a little bit about that.
So healthcare prices are too high in the United States. I mean, for lots of reasons, but the biggest reason is that we pay for too much of our medical care through insurance, whether it's government provided insurance or employer sponsored insurance. And when to the point where we're only paying for 10% of our medical care directly, the patient only pays for 10 cents on the dollar on average for every dollar's worth of medical care they consume. And when they, when your financial interest in getting lower prices or avoiding wasteful care is so small, when you're only going to see 10% of the savings and 90% are going to go to someone else, you don't even bother, really. I mean, or I should say, you shop around a lot less than you would if you were paying 100% of the cost. That's true of medical care. It's true of health insurance. And so consumers don't care about prices, about getting the lowest possible price because they're spending someone else's money, and employers and government are not very good at negotiating lower prices either. But the chart that you're talking about is one that shows the results of an experiment where some employers, one of them is the state of California, in its capacity as an employer, did an experiment where they had their enrollees, they couldn't get the prices down for a whole bunch of different services. So they created this experiment where the enrollees would be spending their own money on those items. And these are things like CT and MRI scans, colonoscopies, shoulder and knee arthroscopy, hip and knee replacements. So some pretty invasive surgeries, elective, but pretty major surgeries. And what they found was that when the consumers were spending their own money on these items, prices plummeted. Over a 2-year period, prices came down dramatically. For hip and knee replacements, they came down at the high price hospitals by about 37% over a 2-year period.
Wow.
That tells us two things. One, the insurance companies, the employers, were not very good at negotiating lower prices. Okay, that they were paying these really exorbitant prices for all of these items. And two, as soon as you gave the consumer an incentive to ask about price, because they get to keep 100% of the savings, some remarkable things happen that are not supposed to happen in healthcare. If you listen to most health policy wonks, consumers started asking for price information. They got transparent price information. They started changing their behavior based on that price information. They switched hospitals. About a sixth of the market for hip and knee replacements went to lower price hospitals. And the hospitals changed their behavior. They started reducing their prices. They went to insurance companies and said, we know we have these prices written into our contracts. Can we reopen those contracts to lower our prices because we're getting killed here? And these are monopolist hospitals that, you know, we need antitrust or whatever to protect us from. Really, you don't. You just need price-sensitive consumers because they will spark price competition that will get prices down far below what insurance companies or the government will be able to negotiate. And if you want healthcare to be universal, falling prices should be your obsession, because that is how we make everything more universal. That's how we've made food so much more universal that we are keeping 8 billion people alive on this planet right now, a feat the humans have never accomplished before. That wasn't government subsidies or regulation or price controls that did that. That was innovation that drove down the prices for food. And we need to do the same thing to make healthcare more universal.
Yeah. And, you know, I think when you have these conversations with folks, there's something that seems just sacrosanct about healthcare, I think, to a lot of people, that, you know, we understand that there is and should be competition in food or in clothing or, you know, other consumer goods, right? And people understand what it means to shop around. And now so more than ever with all of the internet and mobile options that we have. But somehow when you tell them, well, we need a better market than in healthcare as well, that I think they have a reaction to that. Like healthcare is somehow different from other consumer goods. And it might be because in people's minds, you know, in addition to access, there's also this safety component, right? And of course there's a safety component to food and other things as well. But I think maybe when they think about healthcare, there's just this unique safety component in their mind. And they think that government agencies, like, for example, the FDA, the Federal Food and Drug Administration, are needed to keep us safe from ourselves, but also maybe from drug companies that might give us drugs that are dangerous to us. And so in the book, you do talk about this, except that rather than arguing for more government intervention or more government regulations on safety, you actually argue for the opposite. And again, that may seem kind of counterintuitive to some people. So, if you take kind of the price aspect, if you divorce the price aspect from the conversation, like, what about, why is it that government is actually making medicine less safe?
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's a really big question. Let me start with something that might be a little controversial, provocative with a FedSoc audience, which is that in one chapter of the book, I argue that government should be doing more, mm-hmm. more to make patients safer. It should be regulating more. That's the chapter on medical malpractice liability. The reason we have a medical malpractice, a tort system generally, and medical malpractice torts and products liability torts, is because those systems are freedom enhancing, because if a doctor or a pharmaceutical company can impose on me risks or costs without my consent, if a doctor operates on the wrong body part or a hospital lets me get an avoidable hospital acquired infection, if they can do that with impunity, then I'm not really free. Because I'm not free to make my own health decisions if other people can impose those unwanted costs on me. And we have a tort system not only to make me whole if they harm me, but also to create incentives so that they provide better care. So that's where I argue government should be playing an active role in improving the safety of medical goods and services. Unfortunately, what happens in states and to some extent at the federal level, when it comes to the med mal system and the products liability system, is what happens often at the federal level when the government gets involved in any area of healthcare or any other regulation, it's regulatory capture. The industry goes to the state legislature and says, we want you to put caps on non-economic damages, or we want you to limit the patient's right to sue in this way, so that it creates situations where if a doctor in Texas imposes costs on me in excess of the Texas's cap on non-economic damages, then I have to bear those costs. Even if I can get a jury to bring an award against this doctor, I have to bear those costs, which means Texas has made me less free. And a lot of people won't be able to get a lawyer to represent them in a med-mal case. And if you've ever listened to the Wondery podcast about Dr. Death, Dr. John Dunch, mm-hmm. yep. It interviews one of my Cato colleagues, law professor Charlie Silver, about that very point. The Texas's caps have kept Dr. Dunch's victims from filing lawsuits against him. So in that area, I argue that that states should get rid of those sorts of caps and limits on the right to sue, but then also let patients and providers implement their own med mal reforms via contract by directing judges to honor those contracts. That was a long first part of the answer. I didn't even get to like the FDA and how that makes people less safe and what to do about that.
But I'm glad you went there because I do think you're right. People who are traditional Federalist Society audience might be a little surprised by that chapter in the book at first, but I think what you're talking about are two very different things here, right? I mean, having a system of government that holds people accountable and holds people accountable to contractual and other obligations. I mean, that really is the rule of law, as a libertarian or a free market person would speak of it. That seems to be the basic role of government. But what that sort of morphed into, as you've said, we've had regulatory capture, we've put all sorts of limitations on those things and on people's ability to contract with each other. But also as a way to sort of maybe make things more efficient in their minds, or maybe to put, the bureaucrats that seem to be more experts in the area more in charge. We've sort of seen a shift over the course of the 20th century and beyond to regulating, not responding when somebody is wronged, which creates, I think, good incentives, but actually regulating is sort of like before people are even able to act, right? And that's kind of what the FDA does. But it's not a situation that, this company or this doctor wronged a patient and so they need to be held accountable. But it's more, well, let's think about all the ways that you could potentially harm a patient, or let's just think about where those risks and, weighing should actually be, the risk versus benefit. It seems that rather than giving the patient the opportunity to weigh those things for his or herself, the government's kind of saying, well, no, we're going to step out in front and we're going to set those standards. So I think, and I certainly don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems to me like there's a real difference between what you're talking about and, a traditional system of government accountability for wrongdoings and this regulatory behemoth that we have now that is represented by, among other agencies, the FDA.
Yeah, well, I don't think they're consistent because limits on the tort system or limits on a jury's ability to award damages to a victim of medical malpractice or something like that, they do limit government. They limit the redistribution through the tort system, but they also limit freedom for the reasons I mentioned. Whereas if you reduce the FDA's role in the health sector, that enhances freedom because the FDA, as you mentioned, doesn't wait around to see if, this producer harmed this consumer and now we're going to act. The FDA says, we are going to make decisions for everybody about this drug until we're happy or until we're satisfied that the safety and efficacy profiles are, that it is safe and effective according to our standards. Well, safety, whether taking a drug versus not taking a drug, whether taking a drug is safer than not taking it is a purely subjective question. It's a balancing of the risks and benefits of both options that would be often considerable uncertainty. And what the FDA does is you don't get to make that decision for yourself. We're going to make it for you, at least up until a point. And that then ends up denying people the right to make their own health decisions in really critical situations where they might have a terminal illness and they've run out of other options. And so having an agency like the FDA that imposes that prior restraint on market access for certain pharmaceuticals takes away your rights to make your own health decisions. And as I also discuss in the book, it ends up making you less safe because the FDA causes more harm by delaying safe and effective drugs from getting to the market than it prevents by blocking ineffective or harmful drugs from getting to the market. So there's not even a utilitarian rationale for the FDA to wield those powers. And I not only make that case in the book, I also talk about some of the ways that markets, but for the FDA and other government interventions, would provide much better safety assurance outside of, you know, the medical malpractice system.
Yeah, I think there's two things we're talking about here. There's sort of that seen and unseen, right? We all know when the FDA blocks a dangerous or potentially dangerous drug from getting to the market, that's good. We're happy about that. People praise the FDA. But what you're talking about is what they don't see is if they delay or even completely block a drug that could help people improve their lives or even save their lives, how many people suffer or even die because of that decision. We can sort of try to quantify that, but we don't even know because those people are never given that opportunity. But something that you also talked about that I think we hear less about in the book is how sometimes, you know, treatments or drugs that are approved by the FDA end up being problematic. So it's not even really serving that function that we think it's supposed to serve. And I think you gave the example, was it Vioxx that you talk about in the book? Yeah. I don't want to give away all the spoilers of the book, but why don't you talk about that a little bit? Cause I thought that was a really good illustration of that example.
So Vioxx was a painkiller that Merck introduced onto the market, 20 or more years ago? Yeah. So long ago that when I give this part of the talk to the interns, I now have to explain to them what Vioxx is because they've never heard of it before. But it was this blockbuster painkiller. Merck was making a lot of money on it. It went through the FDA's approval process. The FDA deemed it safe and effective. And once it got out onto the market, though, some people started wondering, hey, could this drug be having some side effects that we didn't know about before? Could it be responsible for this spate of heart attacks and other cardiac events that we're observing? But, you know, now the FDA's randomized controlled trials that the FDA required Merck to do before it would approve the drug and that the FDA reviewed did not find any statistically significant side effects along these lines. There might have been a little blip there, but it was so small that it wasn't statistically significant in trials of a few thousand patients. But once this drug got out onto the market and millions of people started taking it, those blips got a little bit bigger and people began to wonder, is this just a statistical anomaly or is it actually that this drug is causing adverse cardiac events? What ended up happening, I think, is fascinating and instructive if what you care about is protecting patients from unsafe drugs and getting them access to safe drugs and effective drugs as fast as possible. The FDA ultimately pulled Vioxx off the market. They decided, yes, it is causing adverse cardiac events. But it wasn't the FDA that conducted the studies that established that. It wasn't the FDA that mandated the studies that established that. It wasn't Merck either. The organization that finally collected the data that convinced the FDA that this drug was dangerous and that they should recommend that Merck take it off the market. It's actually a health insurance company, a special kind of health insurance company that really only exists in its purest form on the West Coast. And we call that health insurance company Kaiser Permanente. It's unique for a number of reasons. The biggest one is that it combines this organization combines both health insurance and healthcare delivery. So Kaiser has its own hospitals and there's a Kaiser Permanente Medical Group, which is where all the doctors work. And they all are sort of under the same corporate umbrella. And that means that there's a much closer relationship between the health plan and the providers, the doctors. It also creates different incentives than all other insurance companies and doctors face in the health sector. Incentives that, for reasons I could explain, encourage Kaiser to use electronic health records. Kaiser has been using those since the 1960s. You know, most of us still don't have a functional electronic medical record. No. And yet Kaiser has been using those for years. And now where people can choose their own health plans, which is small corners of the market of the United States, where there's overlap with Kaiser because it's only available in certain corners. They advertise that fact that, you know, we have electronic medical records and checking lab results and all that sort of thing. the fact that they use, that they have those, that they have the incentives to use those medical records, and unique incentives among healthcare providers to weed out unsafe and wasteful expenditures, meant that they were able to do a retrospective observational study of all of their enrollees, millions of enrollees who had taken Vioxx, compare them to controls, you know, synthetic controls. They did the best they could. It wasn't a prospective randomized trial, but, you know, it was the best that was available with a much larger sample size than the FDA's pre-market approval trials. And they found evidence that it was causing these adverse cardiac events. That was the evidence that convinced the FDA that the FDA should pull this drug from the market. And if you think about it, what this means is that the private sector, the market, Kaiser Permanente beat the FDA at the FDA's own job.
Yeah.
Kaiser did a better job of protecting patients here because it was able to do what the FDA was not. The FDA does not have the power to mandate trials that are, you know, have millions of people in them. And thank God, because there'd be no more medicines probably,
right.
Or a lot fewer medicines that would come to market. But Kaiser was able to do that. And what this points to is how a market would have developed safety and efficacy certification for drugs without the FDA. It probably would have been plans like Kaiser that do, like the NHS does. The British National Health Service is basically a government-run Kaiser Permanente. The NHS says to drug companies, if you want us to cover your drug, you give us the drug, we'll run the randomized controlled trials, we'll tell you if it works and how much we'll pay for it. There's no reason Kaiser couldn't do the same, but the FDA has crowded out that function, so there's no incentive for markets to do that themselves. And lots, as I discuss in the book, lots of other regulations have prevented Kaiser from spreading and other people from launching other health plans like Kaiser that have its same organizational structure and incentives. So that is how I think a market system would have provided even better safety and efficacy certification for new medical technologies than government is right now.
Yeah. And you know, what I love about that example and just your approach in the book generally is that, I mean, it really illustrates how incentives that exist in the market that do not exist in government systems really drive a lot of these, this information sharing, these innovations, you know, prices to drop, access to increase, safety, all of these things. And I think that is important because, you know, sometimes we hear people who are talking, who are arguing for less government in healthcare, they come at it, they approach this by saying, well, you know, these bureaucrats, they don't care about people, or they want people to get sick, or, you know, it's all about money or power or whatever. And I like that you acknowledge that. You know, I think a lot of people in that work for the FDA or that, you know, these politicians that want to improve the healthcare system, they come at it with good intentions, right? And probably some of them don't, but we can assume that a lot of them do. And it's not that the FDA wants to keep helpful medicines from people or wants to see people suffer and die. It's that the system that they have set up, that these intervening government systems, they make it impossible for people to be able to get the best and most affordable treatments and healthcare simply by virtue of how they operate. And so I think that's important. It's an important point to keep in mind. And that, you know, that everybody, I think at the end of the day, just about everybody wants a healthcare system that's more accessible and that gives people the best care. It's just about how we get there, right?
Yeah. You know, everybody who pays attention to the FDA, every FDA wonk or analyst knows the name David Graham. David Graham was an FDA employee who argued the FDA should not have approved Vioxx. He argued this drug is not safe. And he was one of the people who I think went to Kaiser Permanente. I'm glad David Graham is there. I love the David Grahams of the world who have values different from mine, maybe even are even more risk averse than I am, because they are the ones who will demand more evidence about whether this drug works or not. And so I believe that David Graham and lots of others, a lot of people vilified him, but I believe that he and lots of others at the FDA are just trying to keep people safe.
Yep.
The problem is that they have a big information problem. They get a lot of information about one type of safety problem and almost zero information about another type of safety problem. And as a result, they only try to stop the first type of safety problem, even at the expense of causing even more harm by increasing the number of the other kind. And what we're talking about here is, of course, safety problems of letting unsafe drugs onto the market versus blocking beneficial drugs. And in this book, I say that this information asymmetry, this information problem is so great that there are studies that show that the FDA causes 6 to 12 times as much harm by blocking drugs, beneficial drugs from the market, as it does by keeping unsafe drugs off of the market. Mm-hmm. Even though it's the David Grahams that do that. I'm so glad that there are David Grahams in the world. I just don't think they should have the sort of power that they have over our health decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the book has a lot more examples of, you know, how government-centric healthcare has really caused probably unintentional but very bad outcomes, including, we're not going to have time to get into it today, but including a really fascinating discussion about foreign policy, which I think most people wouldn't necessarily put those two things together. So definitely check out the book to get more on that. But before we go, I want to talk about the you also include in the book a number of solutions, what we can do to actually fix some of these problems. And I wondered if we could just touch on a little bit of that. And we're recording this in March of 2024, when both parties in Congress have released their proposed budgets. And it looks like, Michael, your book has been influential in the Republican budget, at least. So maybe we can kind of talk a little bit about that. But tell me just a little bit. We certainly don't have time to go through all of them, of course. That's why folks should pick up the book Recovery and read about them, read about these solutions for themselves. But tell us a little bit about some of the most important reforms that you've included in the book, and maybe about some of them that seem to be gaining a little bit of traction, at least with some members of Congress.
Yeah, the healthcare, just to tease the foreign policy angle a little bit, healthcare governs everything, even U.S. foreign policy. And if you want to know why, read the book. But as far as reforms, yeah, I did hear, I saw in the House Republican Regional Budget Proposal, there was some healthcare proposals that mirrored what I proposed in the book, both on when it comes to the tax treatment of healthcare and the Medicare program and also the Medicaid program. And I would say that without going into detail about all of those proposals, they all fall under two basic categories. One is that we need to change who controls the money in our health sector. As I mentioned before, the government right now controls 83% of the money. And there's $4 trillion sloshing around in the U.S. health sector. We should just take all of that and let the consumers control it. Let workers control their earnings instead of their employers. Give seniors in the Medicare program a check like Social Security does, where, you know, give sick people bigger checks and low-income people bigger checks so that they can afford the medical care that they need, but then trust them to spend it just like Social Security does. You do these and a couple of other things, and all of a sudden, consumers will control that $4 trillion, and the system will have to start responding to them, like it did in those experiments we mentioned, where consumers got not just price information, but falling prices and more accessible universal care. The other category is removing barriers to lower cost, higher quality healthcare. Just reforming the Medicare program will do by giving seniors cash will eliminate a lot of perverse incentives that subsidize and protect low quality, high cost providers. But there are a lot of things that the states do and that the federal government does to block entry by by health plans like Kaiser Permanente that can improve the quality of care on a lot of dimensions and make it more affordable, to health plans that cost dramatically less than Obamacare plans do and will make health insurance more universal that way. Health plans that are also higher quality than Obamacare so that they don't contain Obamacare's perverse incentives to erode care for the sick, which is something that President Biden's economic advisor, Michael Caruso, says is happening in Obamacare right now. There's a whole raft of reforms of these sorts of barriers to lower cost, higher quality care that exist at both the federal and the state levels. The book probably talks about all of them, but succinctly and in an accessible way.
Well, Michael, I really do encourage folks to pick up the book, and it is true that it is a very, very important read. There's a lot of information packed in there, but you managed to do so in a very small package, which I think a lot of busy folks will appreciate. So before I let you go, last question for you. Do we have reason to be optimistic? You know, I think there's a lot of people who just assume that the U.S. health sector is so far gone. It's been so captured by the government. And for so long, people are so used to the systems like, employer-sponsored health insurance and all of this. Is there hope that some of the reforms that you've proposed in the book, which could really turn things around, would be adopted?
I would understand if you looked at the state of our health sector and looked at the political climate right now and came to the conclusion that, no, there is no hope. Abandon all hope, ye who enter. However, I also like to hearken back to, people say that Winston Churchill said, you can always trust the American people to do the right thing once they've exhausted every alternative. And so I know that we will do the right thing on healthcare. I know we will begin respecting people's rights to make their own health decisions. Right now, we're just exhausting the alternatives. And it turns out there's a lot of alternatives. But I think eventually, with time, with effort by us here at the Cato Institute, the Federalist Society, and others, we'll educate more of the public and policymakers about the harms that taking away people's health care rights do to them as individuals, to the affordability of healthcare, and so forth, that the truth will out and that we will get the sort of reforms that I talk about in the book.
Well, Michael, thank you as always for a really great discussion. Thank you to the Federalist Society. And I do want to remind listeners, for those who haven't already picked up a copy of Michael's excellent book, Recovery, I highly encourage you to do so. We've only just scratched the surface in this conversation. So thank you again.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.